I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush stood on the floor of the General Assembly of the United Nations today to defend the war in Iraq, saying someone had to take responsibility for Saddam Hussein.
Finally, the Security Council promised serious consequences for his defiance. And the commitments we make must have meaning. When we say serious consequences for the sake of peace, there must be serious consequences.
The president's speech followed one by Secretary General Kofi Annan, who said last week that the U.S. invasion of Iraq violated international law. Well, how important was the president's speech today? How important is the U.N.? Joining us first is U.N. reporter Linda Fasulo. She attended this morning's proceedings. And Linda, the president's other reported goal, other than defending Iraq, was to shift the conversation from Iraq to worldwide human rights. Did he succeed?
Well, I guess the answer is we'll have to wait and see. He certainly brought up the issues of fighting terrorism and the need for the world to now focus, you know, in a concerted effort to stop the terrorists and to advance human rights. But it's not clear exactly how the speech, you know, was really received. The audience was rather subdued. But I must say at the end there was polite applause.
What was the overall tone of the president?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I've watched him for several years now, and of course each year it's been a rather different speech. But this year I have to say he sounded more diplomatic than his usual way. As one of my colleagues said, he sounded more like a diplomat than a cowboy. It was not a kind of speech you would imagine him giving on the campaign trail.
Yeah. Well, as we know, the UN Security Council didn't support the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, but in today's speech, President Bush also seemed to shift some of his requests. He asked the General Assembly for help bolstering security and ensuring safe elections. Here's how he presented that.
The UN and its member nations must respond to Prime Minister Alawi's request and do more to help build an Iraq that is secure, democratic, federal, and free.
Prime Minister Alawi was there, we understand. How was that line received that you could tell?
I mean, I think, first of all, Alawi was in the audience, which was very interesting, and of course that's his debut on the international stage, and he's scheduled to speak later in the week. But I think that we'll have to wait and see how the response to Alawi is. I mean, I think there's growing strength in terms of certain countries, you know, believing that it's important now to help Iraq in its reconstruction efforts and not to abandon it.
And it seems as if the president almost gave them wiggle room. If they may not want to accede to President Bush's requests, well, this is Prime Minister Alawi's request.
Exactly. It's really like a twin performance in the sense that Bush is, you know, laying the groundwork, and then later in the week on Friday, Alawi will be there, and he himself will implore the international community to come and help his country.
Yeah.
And it's always also very interesting how the president focused on the need for democracy and the spreading of democracy around the world, and how Afghanistan and Iraq are really two possibilities for democracy in the Middle East, and how the nations of the world, peaceful nations, should support this. I thought he was a little bit moving in terms of talking about democracy and how everyone in everyone's heart, no matter what culture, whether traditional or modern society, people want to be free. You know, basically trying to move forward the concept that democracy can be applied everywhere and has to be supported.
Different speeches from the last speeches you've seen, which were about defending against. This is about spreading.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. I think he was trying to rally the troops, so to speak, rally the international community to come and support efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq, and as really launching pads for spreading democracy in that part of the world.
Yeah. Linda Fasulo covers the United Nations, and we appreciate it. Linda, thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And joining us now for an international perspective is Professor Michael Cox, a specialist in transatlantic studies at the London School of Economics. Welcome, Professor.
Welcome to you.
And David Shore, he's program officer for the U.S.-UN Relations Program at the Stanley Foundation in Iowa. Welcome to you, David, as well.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to talk about some of the things the president raised today later on, including Sudan. But first, David, the president's tough tightrope act on Iraq, He needs the UN to help his efforts in Iraq. But he's also been using his stump speeches to chastise, even make fun of the UN for not supporting the U.S.-led war in Iraq. So what do you think? Did he continue to please his base this morning? Did he smooth any feathers at the UN, or can you do both?
Well, slightly differently from what Linda was just saying, actually, I think that's a message that that I can hear on the campaign trail. I mean, certainly the Republican National Convention, when they were speaking to the party faithful, there was a lot of UN bashing. But as he goes looking for that swing voter, actually, I think a message today that's more supportive of the UN is one that he thinks probably will help him.
Right. You were mentioning the RNC. Dick Cheney made a comment at the convention about how John Kerry would, I'm paraphrasing now, would fight terrorism only at the direction of the UN. And President Bush has said on the campaign trail, we're not going to ask for a permission slip to defend America, seeming to imply that that's what Kerry would do with the UN.
The U.S. election is never a place that you're going to get a really enlightened discourse on policy. So there's definitely a lot of rhetoric out there. And I think the fact of the matter is, of course, that no American president from either party is going to feel absolutely bound by what the U.N. says when it comes to protecting U.S. security.
Right. But, Michael, how did this speech read to you today? I mean, the president was unapologetic, if more diplomatic. Should he have been a little more hat in hand? The last time, or one of the last times he went before the Security Council, it was with what the U.S. called proof of weapons of mass destruction, and they haven't been found.
Yeah, and also, I'd also point out that earlier in the week, or a few days ago, rather, Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the UN, actually announced that the war in Iraq was illegal. So the background to push President's speech to the UN today is a background of extraordinarily bad relations with the United Nations, with a number of key members of the permanent members of the Security Council, including France, and generally a very bad situation indeed for the U.S. in relationship to the U.N. I think the possibility, frankly, given the deteriorating situation on the ground of Iraq, of any level of either U.N. support for or European support for or even global support for serious military or serious economic support for what's happening in Iraq at the moment, I think is almost zero.
As you said, Kofi Annan also, in addition to criticizing, we should say he didn't say the war was illegal last week. So he said that it violated international law, and some would say, would you say it was illegal?
Well,
he said, if you wish.
I interpreted that as he moved around, but he came as close as it was close to say that the war was not legal or outside the law. It was pretty close. It sounded like illegal to me.
Well, Eaton, we have some tape of Secretary General Kofi Annan, who also spoke today prior to President Bush. He seemed in part to, well, continue to be delivering a lecture to the U.S. Let's listen.
Yet today, the rule of law is at risk around the world. Again and again, we see laws shamelessly disregarded. Those that ordain respect for innocent life, for civilians, for the vulnerable, especially children. To mention only a few flagrant and topical examples, in Iraq, we see civilians massacred in cold blood, while relief workers, journalists, and other non-combatants are taken hostage and put to death in the most barbarous fashion. At the same time, we have seen Iraqi prisoners disgracefully abused. In Darfur, we see whole populations displaced and their homes destroyed, while rape is used as a deliberate strategy.
I'm sorry, that was actually a portion of Kofi Annan's speech this morning where he was speaking of the same things that President Bush was speaking, atrocities around the world. But at another moment, he was speaking of a different kind of rule of law. Let's listen.
At times, even the necessary fight against terrorism is allowed to encroach unnecessarily on civil liberties.
David Shore, again with the U.S. UN Relations Program at the Stanley Foundation in Iowa. What does this say to us?
And then there was another moment in the Secretary General's speech when he talked about the importance of not making might make right, but instead to make right make might. What I think is important to keep in mind as we're thinking about the help that the U.S. is asking of the U.N. is this is we have to remember how sensitive this is for the U.N. Just over a year ago, the bombing on the U.N. headquarters in Baghdad killed some of the U.N.'s most valuable personnel and really should be seen as the United Nations September 11th. So it's a loaded issue of whether U.N. personnel are going to be back in Iraq. Mm-hmm. So, and the other thing, of course, that related to that and the, you know, the roots behind that attack is that the U.N. needs to be careful not to be seen as a U.S. puppet. So all of that is in there. Besides which, it's important to remember that the help is, in a strict sense, not really needed from the UN itself, as it is from other countries to come in with the security forces to provide security for the UN.
Well, Michael, let's ask you, bottom line, did the president gain any ground in that effort to get either the UN and troops or other countries and troops and money? Did he gain any ground today?
Well, I don't want to sound like the European pessimist on all these issues, and I tend to do so, and I'm talking to my friends across the Atlantic in the United States, but I'd have to be pretty pessimistic at this point in time. I mean, President Bush was in Europe over the summer in June and July. He went to NATO, he went to the EU, and frankly, he came back with very little. And so I'm still very, very pessimistic. The reality is twofold, really, very, very briefly. One, there was a lot of European opposition to this war at the very beginning, and that has only intensified since the end of the war for all the reasons we know about. And I don't think many Europeans feel very much inclined, therefore, to get involved. The other thing, frankly, is that the situation within Iraq itself is so dangerous. It is now one of the most dangerous countries in the world. No foreigners are safe at all within Iraq itself at the current moment. And I frankly feel that most European governments will feel very, very reluctant indeed to commit any of their nationals at the moment on the ground, given the hostage taking. At the moment, an American was executed, murdered yesterday. There's a British person and another American held by one of the groups there at the moment. You know, many, many, many more have been executed, killed, and murdered in the most appalling circumstances. I think under these circumstances, hardly any other country is going to commit very, very much at all to the UN in real terms.
That's Professor Michael Cox of the London School of Economics. We're also talking with David Shore of the Stanley Foundation in Iowa. I tell you what, both of you, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, pose a few other questions. For instance, why do so many Americans hate the UN? And then Darfur, just because Colin Powell says the situation in Sudan is genocide, does that make it so? Well, China doesn't think so, and they've got a vote in the UN. So stay with us. We'll have that conversation. And then later, author Cynthia Ozick's latest novel. It was inspired by a real-life obituary she read about the death of Christopher Robin. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've been speaking with Professor Michael Cox of the London School of Economics. Welcome back, Professor.
Hello there.
And David Shore, Program Coordinator of the U.S.-UN Relations at the Stanley Foundation in Iowa. Hi, David.
Hi.
And we're doing all of this in light of President Bush's speech today at the United Nations. And, David, to you, obviously members of the U.N. are keenly aware of the election coming up and of the fact that they may not be dealing with this current president come January. How does that affect the way the General Assembly, the Security Council, react to President Bush?
Well, picking up on what Michael was saying a moment ago about how hard it's going to be to get any other countries to commit forces on the ground, I'm having a little trouble here.
It's okay. You were talking about the difficulty in getting the world community, because it is so unsafe in Iraq, to respond to President Bush's plea.
Exactly. And it's all well and good. We were talking about this speech earlier that it sounded very diplomatic. But, of course, you know, at this point, one diplomatic speech doesn't make up for all of the lack of effort over the months and in Iraq to build the coalition and to make those alliances.
Yeah. And Michael, the state of U.S.-UN relations has been deteriorating for a while. This is nothing new. The U.S. is behind in its dues payments and has frequently criticized the U.N. Are some of the critics correct? Last year, for instance, we saw Libya appointed head of the Human Rights Commission of the U.N.
Yeah, I think one's got to make a distinction here between, you know, what are genuine and fair-minded criticisms of the U.N., and there are some genuine and fair-minded criticisms of the UN to be made. I mean, there is a lot of guff talked at the UN sometimes. A number of very unpleasant, unsavory regimes end up doing some very odd things, as you just mentioned. And so there are some fair-minded, and there's genuine reform to be made of the UN. I'd like to see a reform of the Security Council. I'd like to see Japan. I'd like to see Germany. I'd like to see India, possibly Brazil, included as permanent members. So there's plenty of good things we can do to improve the UN. What we've got to, however, do is make a distinction between fair-minded criticism and, frankly, some of the nonsense which talked in many countries, but also in the United States on the issue. And I think many people on the conservative right in America in particular, and especially those who've had some influence over the Bush presidency, really do see the United Nations as either being irrelevant, beside the point, costing too much, or, most important of all, limiting what America can do. And I think President Bush adhered to some of that criticism of the UN, and I think that was part of the background which led us into that terrible situation which we all got into in the UN when we went for that first and then the second resolution over the war. And I think that's left a bad legacy, both within the UN, in the international community, and has reinforced, I think, that view in the United States amongst certain people that the UN is a very problematic organization. Maybe we should bypass it altogether.
How is that impacting other situations? Why don't you both just stay there for one second? Because the question of Darfur was raised today as well. Colin Powell was the first American to actually call the atrocities there genocide. Moments ago, I spoke with Samkelo Mokina. He's chairman of the South African section of the human rights group Amnesty International. He's just come back from a visit to refugee camps in Darfur, and I asked him to react to UN talk about Sudan.
There's very little or no time. What we've seen is that there are resolutions being taken at various fora, whether it be the United Nations or the Arab League or the African Union. But how that translates into protection for a woman who cannot get out of an internally displaced camp to look for wood for cooking without getting raped or attacked. That's where the crunch is going to be. And the time for really a lot of discussions and resolution is past. We need to make sure that whatever decisions are made by governments do translate into protection and making a difference on the ground in Darfur itself.
What do you see as the holdup? As you said, there have been resolutions. What's the problem as you see it?
It's really a matter of reducing those resolutions to concrete action. One of the issues that we have raised as Amnesty is that the militia, so-called Janjaweed, must be disarmed and disbanded. Whatever resolution is taken, it should make sure that at the bottom level, the Sudanese government should be forced to disarm and disband the Janjaweed, because these are the people who attack villagers and who've caused so much displacement, killings, and misery within Darfur.
But as you know, Samkelo, there are voting members of the United Nations who are against any kind of troops, for instance, in Sudan. They feel that would further exacerbate the problem and that it should be worked through diplomatically. There are some Arab countries who feel that this is only being led by the United States because it's an attack against an Arab-led country. What do you do about those questions?
In our meetings with senior officials of government, one thing that they outlined and seem to outline in totality is the fact that the one institution they trust is the African Union. So as much as is possible should be done within the African Union. The African Union is a relatively new body and does not have much capacity. They have monitors and they have troops on the ground, but those monitors are not enough. They do not even have enough equipment. So the trick here is to make sure that you use a channel that is trusted by the government.
And why don't they trust the UN?
They think the UN is manipulated by the United States government, in short.
So there you have it. Michael Cox of the London School of Economics. We've just about a minute left. So what happens now? President Bush asked for help from the world body. Those who need the help may not trust it. What, just in the minute we have, what happens?
Well, very, very quickly. I mean, you know, there's an old saying in England, you know, then was then, now is now. I think we have to draw a line under many of the disputes and arguments that we've had over this war and recognize, frankly, that we're all in this situation together, not only in Iraq, but in the world. And unless we get international cooperation, a recognition of international laws, working together, we're going to get things. We're not going to get things solved. We either go together or we hang separately, and that's the way I see it. And much of the criticism of the United States is that it's gone on a kind of unilateral detour. And not only is it weakened world order, it's weakened itself. And we want to see a strong America, because without a strong America, we don't see a stable and just world.
We're going to have to leave it at that today. Michael Cox is a professor of the London School of Economics. We've also been talking to David Shore, program coordinator of the U.S.-UN relations at the Stanley Foundation. David, thank you as well.
Thank you.
It's a conversation that is going to be continued as the slaughter in Sudan continues. Thank you both.
Thanks.
And stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. With less than 6 weeks to go until the U.S. presidential election, the political messages are everywhere. And this year, those messages even made it into movie theaters. Two new films with opposite perspectives look at the issue of Democratic presidential hopeful John Kerry's record in Vietnam. We'll speak with the producers of both films this week. And today we hear from George Butler, director of the movie Going Upriver, The Long War of John Kerry. That film premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival last week and will be in U.S. theaters next week. George Butler spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Why this film about John Kerry at this time?
I've always wanted to make a film about John. I've known him since 1964. I think his life is a remarkable story, and there's a kind of hidden John Kerry, which the film looks at.
Who is the hidden John Kerry? What did you learn about him that you didn't know before doing the film, even though you've known him for 40 years?
When I first screened this in the editing room, my editors just couldn't believe the nature of the combat, with bullet holes all over the place in the water and swift boats that were coming in from combat looking as if they'd literally been peppered with gunshot. And I think this movie will settle once and for all whether or not John was in combat, and if it was indeed only for 4 months, it was some of the fiercest combat in any war.
There are those who say, at least at crucial times when he was supposed to have faced action, there are some who are charging that he didn't.
You know, I'm an experienced interviewer, and I did 100 hours of interviews at least for this film. And you can pick up very quickly where the truth lies in this.
What do you think we need to know about John Kerry's time in Vietnam that we didn't already know? It's been examined, his experience there, pretty closely.
The nature of the combat in Vietnam is put out on screen, and you can see the kinds of things that were happening in Vietnam. The nature of my filmmaking is to really examine what is within someone's character and to show it, not to tell it. The film I've made has no narration at all, which is extremely difficult to accomplish in a documentary. And the reason for that is that John Kerry's story tells itself in a rather stunning way.
Why did you choose to not interview John Kerry himself?
It's an editorial choice. I did ask John Kerry for an interview, and due to the pressures of the campaign, I never got it. And in reflection, I think the film is actually better for not introducing John in the present.
One of the most talked about parts of the film is where John Kerry questions a veteran of the Winter Soldiers event back in 1971 when vets testified about the violence of warfare. Describe the scene for us, if you would.
Well, there's about a five-minute sector on Winter Soldier, and it's a pivotal moment in American history in the sense that, here were vets for the first time questioning publicly an American war in Vietnam.
And so when 30 years from now our brothers go down the street without a leg, without an arm or a face, and small boys ask why, we will be able to say Vietnam, and not mean a desert, not a filthy, obscene memory, but mean instead the place where America finally turned, and where soldiers like us helped it in the turning.
And at the time, it was, primal stuff, but in the hindsight of history, it's very difficult to position anything favorable that came to America from fighting the war in Vietnam.
What do you say to people who are going to view this film as an infomercial for candidate Kerry?
The best biography written in literature is acknowledged to be Boswell's Life of Johnson. They were close friends. There are lots of precedents where an artist or an author or a filmmaker has made a film about a close friend.
But let me ask you this question more directly. Was that your intent, to make a film that would intentionally help John Kerry during this, the final couple of months of the presidential campaign?
I'm smart enough and experienced enough to know that if I set out to make a film that would influence an election in America, I'd get nowhere. This is a film that shows John Kerry. It doesn't tell my opinion about him.
The film's distributor said that you re-edited the film to focus exclusively on Kerry's Vietnam experience after Kerry started getting pummeled by the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth and their attacks on John Kerry's experience. And that seems to indicate that, at least to some, that you might have had a political motive.
I've got a great friend named Mark Ehrman, who's head of Think Film, the distributor, and he was quoted in the New York Times saying that I took a hatchet to the film after Swift Boat Veterans appeared. Unfortunately, Mark was absolutely wrong about that, and we've got our signals straight. We edited nothing out of the film or in the film after the Swift Boat controversy. I totally ignored it.
How was the film funded?
The film's been funded by somewhere around 40 investors. A lot of the film's investors are Democrats, but this is perfectly normal.
What do you hope will come from this film?
The best thing that can come from this is someone will say, well, George Butler made a really good film. I also hope that people will say, gosh, I never knew John Kerry was in combat so fierce as what I've seen in this film. And perhaps even more important, you see John Kerry coming back to America and making the most difficult moral choice possible for a soldier, which is to say he thought he had a responsibility to save lives of the living in Vietnam. And his object in his Senate Foreign Relations Committee speech in the March on Washington was to save the lives of those who were alive in Vietnam.
If some historian should write 10, 20, 40 years from now that in the final few weeks of the 2004 campaign, a guy named George Butler released a film about John Kerry's Vietnam experience, and it was a fairly positive film, and that, according to our research now, started a movement that brought the election to John Kerry in the final weeks of the campaign. Would you be proud of that?
I would be cautious in projecting that at this date. We've just finished a film. We think it's good. I have no bragging rights whatsoever.
George Butler, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. I hope we can do this again.
George Butler is the director of the new film, Going Upriver, The Long War of John Kerry.
And that was Here Now's Bob Oak speaking with George Butler. On Thursday, we'll hear from Carlton Sherwood. He's the producer of the movie Stolen Honor, Wounds That Never Heal. That's a film critical of John Kerry's Vietnam record. And still to come, we speak to author Cynthia Ozick. You're listening to Here and Now. The Columbus Washboard Factory in Logan, Ohio, would seem like a company on the edge of obsolescence. Once a staple in many laundry rooms, washboards sold in the U.S. are now used mainly by bluegrass and country bands to make music. Each June, the town of Logan holds a washboard music festival. But recently, the company has noticed a new market developing. Producer Sandra Slate Brennan has the story. She visited the Columbus Washboard Factory, where company manager and co-owner Jackie Barrett talked about the different kinds of washboards the company makes.
We use stainless steel for the musicians. We have galvanized metal, which doesn't rust. Then we have a tin, which is it's actually used, but it's also a decorative item. You can put magnets on it. We make a beautiful brass one that can be used. And, of course, we have the glass ones, which we send overseas to any of the countries that do not want a tin item because it will rust. I would say about 20% of our boards go overseas, a lot of them to the musicians or to felt makers, which is an interesting thing that we've started to do. We're supplying felt makers in England with glass washboards. They scrub the wool on the glass washboard, and it mats together as they're scrubbing it, and that's how they make their felt.
But a year ago, they started getting orders of a different sort.
Well, the first request came from a sergeant from Marysville, Ohio, and his family was familiar with our washboards and they actually used them at their farm. So he asked if I could donate some to his troop. And he was actually the commander for the first group of tanks that went into Bahrain. And so we actually called some of the local service groups and got some donations, and we sent their first shipment to them free. And then from then on, we do sell to Marines' families or soldiers' families, but at a really discounted price.
It seems that all the 21st century technology that the American forces in Iraq have don't help them in one area, laundry. They had to return to 19th century techniques to keep their clothes clean. As soon as the troops reached Iraq, the Columbus Washboard Factory, the last washboard manufacturer in the country, started getting emails. The problem was that the troops in the field didn't have electricity and therefore couldn't wash their clothes. The heat and the sand were taking its toll. Tia Conrad is the office manager at the Columbus Washboard Factory.
And tell me a little bit about the orders you've been getting from Iraq. How do those come in?
Mostly from email, but we get a lot of phone calls, and they're really neat, really nice people. So it's interesting to talk to them, especially when you get the emails from the troops themselves in Iraq. You know, call in or email, and then they send us letters and thank us, and so it's really neat.
What's the reaction of the troops to the washboards?
They love them. I got an email actually this morning from a family member of one of the troops and said that to actually get their laundry to the laundry facility is very dangerous, so they're just doing it right there, you know, basically with a bucket of water. So they're really excited, you know, but men don't know how to use a washboard, so you have to send instructions, and we send soap, and their only request is that we don't send smelly soap anymore because they smell like girls. So that's their only request. But other than that, they love them.
We decided to put together a whole kit for them. We put together a wash tub, washboard, soap, clotheslines, clothespins, instructions, and also foot powder, so that when they've cleaned themselves up, they can put foot powder on and put clean socks on.
The Columbus Washboard Company is a small one. It has only a few employees.
At one time when the economy was better, we actually employed 10 people, and that year we made and sold 80,000 boards. At this time, we are making and selling approximately 30,000 boards. But still, I'm not the only business like this. I know that. Everybody's struggling at this time with the uncertainty in the world. So,
but even with sluggish sales and an uncertain future, the Columbus Washboard Company and its hometown of Logan, Ohio, have an extra reason to celebrate this year. So far, they sent over 3,000 washboards to Iraq. They've extended the concept of community to include our soldiers overseas.
Our visit to the Columbus Washboard Factory was produced by Sandra Slate Brennan. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Once again, author Cynthia Ozick has put together a fantastic stew of characters, a fairy tale based in reality. In her new book, Heir to the Glimmering World, she introduces us to a family of German refugees who've escaped Nazi-controlled Berlin by riding around in a rented limo until they can get out, only to find themselves landing in upstate New York during the Depression. Into their life, Ozick brings James, who as a child was the inspiration for a character in a series of wildly popular American children's books. He's still called the Bear Boy, and he becomes the German family's benefactor. Here's a scene where the two threads of Cynthia Ozick's story first entwine, where the Bear Boy sees the refugee family for the first time.
They were foreigners. Their speech was indistinct. Swedish or Norwegian or such. He would be interested if they were Swedish. They didn't look like Swedes. All the children were dark, and the mother could almost pass for a Jew. But what would Jews be doing here? He saw that the children were growing agitated, though their voices were still low. German. It was German he was hearing, and Germanic wails out of the baby, who wasn't actually a baby. It scampered away from the others. A tiny girl panicking. The older girl snatched the child up and led them all away. They were dressed oddly, the boys in short pants and high socks, the tall girl, womanlike, dark hair wound in braids over her ears, jewels in the lobes. This shocked him. It was so foreign.
Author Cynthia Ozick reading from her novel Heir to the Glittering World, and she joins us from the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It's a pleasure to talk to you after reading the book, which is just so, has, as some said, so many threads in it. You had a whole extra outfit there. Tell us about the family, the Mittwessers. Am I saying that right?
The Mittwesser family are refugees from Berlin, and they have fallen. In Berlin, they were a very high status. The father was a much revered and honored professor of an obscure 9th-century religious heresy, and the mother was a physicist who worked at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute as a colleague of Erwin Schrödinger, who later won the Nobel Prize.
We get an idea of what's ahead in a backstory when you tell of how they escaped. They rented a limousine and kept continuously riding around.
Yes, they rode round and round in Berlin with an unfriendly driver who kept them locked in as he went up to reconnoiter their apartment and see what remained to be looted when he had delivered them to the ship in Hamburg. Mm. They were dependent on this driver, and they drove round and round for a week and for ablutions. They walked through hotel lobbies to use the public facilities of hotels in great fear, hoping they would not be discovered.
Did people really ride around in limousines to escape the Nazis?
Well, this was told to me by such a person who, as a child, escaped with her family, and this is precisely a story that actually occurred.
Well, in addition to the family, we have the so-called Bear Boy. As a child, he was forced to be the inspiration for the central character in his father's world-famous children's books. As an adult, he supports the German family when he's not drunkenly trying to run away from his fame and the fortune it brought him. Why did you throw these people and so many others together?
Well, everybody in this story is a kind of refugee. The Bear Boy, as James the Bear comes to be known, is a refugee from his past. I based him on the real Christopher Robin and put him in an American setting, however. The real Christopher Robin, like my Bear Boy, became a kind of living shrine. The germ of this book was an obituary I found in the New York Times about the real Christopher Milne, who was living, he hoped, an obscure life in the north of England, running a little bookstore, seeking escape from the glimmering world that had been his past, and became deeply estranged from the father who dressed him up in short pants, high socks, and bangs, and created Christopher Robin. So he's a refugee. Everyone here is a type of refugee, and all have lost or are estranged from or are angry with their patrimony.
That is what you wrote of and a little bit of why you wrote it. But I want to just take a second to talk about how you write the similes. A feeling falls over Rose like a fisherman's net when the door opens into the previously closed secretive study of Professor Mittweiser. You write, it's as if an eyelid had lifted. A gray sky is bitten into by zigzag lightning, like a sudden showing of teeth. Teeth come later. An egg is bitten, and it resembles, the little teeth marks that are left resemble a math formula of all things. How does that work? Do you see something and you say, that feels like something, I want to work that in to what I'm working on?
Well, that's a fascinating question, which requires lots of introspection. I think in writing a novel, there are several problems that one needs to be solved. You invent the problems, and then you invent the solutions. One of the problems, of course, is the story and its sources. Another problem is language. And it seems to me that the vital life of the novel exists in the language. And you could have a wonderful story, but if it's told in inferior language, it hasn't got a chance. Think of the imagery in The Great Gatsby, the big advertising sign for eyeglasses, the last image that everyone remembers about the green light shining from the dock across the water. And novels are made up of their stories, their plots, and the images that both express and support the story.
You said, as everyone remembers, and I'm sure a lot of people do, and maybe some people need their memory jogged, but a lot of people aren't reading. And if they are reading, what we're hearing now is they're reading, books about people yelling about their candidate. that seems to be...
Political books in this season, yes.
Yeah. What do you make of that?
Well, I think we all live deeply and passionately in our time, and this is a deeply political time with much at stake, and real readers want to know the issues that face us. But I think that is really not a competition. Real readers will read everything, even the backs of cereal boxes when they're having breakfast. And I don't think that the novel is a rival to the topical book. I think they coexist, and they must coexist, and they always have coexisted. And it seems to me nothing to mourn.
Well, you're talking to someone who has memorized all Bran.
Oh, yes.
And I want to thank you for your latest, so that I could get away from this cereal box. Cynthia Ozick's book is called Heir to the Glimmering World. Cynthia, thank you.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again here and now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.